Grab your girls, grab your beers.
Hey everybody, this is Charlie from Anthrax, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle.
This is Mark Metcalf, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle with Bailey and Domain Cleveland Radio.
You are listening to Today's Boondoggle with Bailey on Domain Cleveland Radio. Yes, Kato Kalen listens to this all the time.
Monty Heath, so one Heath, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle.
Hey, what's up? It's John from Skillet, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle on Domain Cleveland Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts!
What's going on, everybody? It's Bill Bailey.
Sonic Temple Art and Music Festival returns to historic Cruise Stadium. Slipknot, Disturbed, Pantera, The Original Misfits, Evanescence, Limp Bizkit, Judas Priest, Stain, Breaking Benjamin, A Day to Remember, Falling in Reverse, Sleep Token, Rise Again, 311, Seether, Mudvayne, and many more. May 16th through the 19th, Columbus, Ohio. Tickets on sale now at SonicTempleFestival.com.
With today's boondoggle, and a real quick housekeeping note, if you are watching us on YouTube or Rumble or BitChute or Odyssey, please hit that follow and subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on Spotify, Apple, Google, whatever podcast platform you utilize, please hit that follow and subscribe button so we can continue to bring you conversations like the one I'm bringing you today. I'm getting to catch up with my friend Patrick Stone of the band Butterside. What's going on, man?
Just having a beautiful day. Finally, it stopped raining in California, so just enjoying a little bit of sunshine coming through the windows and having a great conversation with a good friend. Sounds like a good day to me.
Oh, yeah, man. It's actually 60 here in Cleveland today, blue skies. So I was out walking the dog earlier, working out and everything. So, it's supposed to get cold again, though, before long, but
it sounds like you have the identical weather that we do. It's about the same temperature here, a little gloomy outside, but you're luckier than I am. You have a dog to walk. I don't have a dog, but someday.
Yeah, you'll get one. It's hard with touring though, unless you can take it on the bus with you or whatever, you know?
Yeah, no, it's better. I'll wait. I'll get one when I'm, I got a nice big backyard, you know?
Yeah, you got a busy schedule ahead of you, which I want to get into with you. But usually when I have somebody on for the first time, I like to get a quick background. So do you remember originally what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I've always wanted to be this. You know, I was rummaging through my sister's record collection. She was a good 8 or 9 years older than I was, and she had all the cool rock albums from Judas Priest to AC/DC. And I think I really clung to Billy Idol first. For some reason, and then she would start cutting my hair like his. So by the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I remember crossing the street with my father, and I think the first time I ever remember him asking me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I was just like, I want to be that. I want to be a big rock star like Billy Idol.
Nice.
So it's always been that, you know.
And then do you remember, you kind of mentioned your sister's record collection and stuff, but do you remember who it was that like really pulled you in that when you started collecting your own?
My own. Yeah. I mean, I was a product of society at that time. So I think Thriller, Michael Jackson, Prince, I never give Prince enough credit. Prince, like, Purple Rain. The first time I saw that movie, everything he did, the way he was, how cool he was, the way he played, you know, the whole club scene, overcoming adversity, all the shit he went through was just like, wow. It was just, yeah, I thought he was the coolest thing ever. So I got to give Prince a lot of credit. Michael Jackson, just because he was, you know, probably the most famous thing on the planet at that time. So I thought that was really inspirational, that he was just so damn talented. And then a couple of other things that I don't give enough credit to often enough is like Pink Floyd. You know, Pink Floyd, and who was the other one? You know, like definitely Pink Floyd, Prince, Billy Idol. AC/DC was so huge. I think that was actually the first thing that really got me, because that Highway to Hell record was the cover of that with Angus holding his tail. That was a glimpse into the dark side that I wanted to be a part of ever since I saw that album cover.
Nice. And then, when was it that, you decided, okay, I'm going to actually start performing or getting into, taking music more serious?
Well, my mom was really nurturing with everything I did. I think my first concerts were really to her all the time, singing in the car. And I remember every time we got in the car, I would turn up the radio, and she was always kind of surprised that I knew every lyric to every song that was on the radio playing, whatever it was. I could sing along to all of it. And she was cool enough to let me sing the whole time. I think to myself now, if I had a kid and they were singing in the car all the time, I'd be like, at least half of the time, I'd be like, can you please just give me some quiet for this one drive? But she let me sing all the time. So there was always that. And then, I think in fourth grade, my first role as the lead. I played Thomas Edison in the Electric Company. So it was a singing acting part. And I remember there was 2 hours of a script that I had memorized, and then I had to sing and dance and all this crap. And I remember afterwards, I was just, the audience and everybody that was there was, congratulating me on what a great job I did. And I knew that felt really good. So that was probably the first one, other than, maybe a talent show here or a talent show there, or singing in front of the people at my mom's and dad's parties was always something too. They slide me a little wine cooler and I'd take a sip of that. And then I was so confident I would grab my sister's guitar and, start playing in front of everybody at the parties, and they were, oh yeah. So something like that.
Nice. And then, you said your mom was pretty encouraging with you singing in the car and everything, but then did they get you in any kind of like lessons? You also mentioned kind of playing your sister's guitar. Did you do any lessons?
So around, between 5 and 8 years old, I started playing with her guitar. I still have that guitar in my bedroom. And I started learning kind of on my own. I remember there's kind of a competition between my brother and I. He wanted to be a drummer, and we kind of started a band together. But then he would pick up the guitar, and then he would noodle with it. And I felt like he was getting further ahead than me. And then I'd jump on his drum set, and then I felt like I was getting a little further than him. There was a minute there where I thought I was really going to enjoy the drums. But then it was it was this song, Wipeout, Wipe. So super simple, but that was the first. I remember sitting on the couch in the living room and getting that riff down, and I was like, whoa, this is so cool, like feeling the beat and feeling the music. So that was about the time that I got a little spun off there. What was the question? What were we talking about?
When did you start getting lessons to
lessons, right? So then from there, I felt like I was probably talented enough that I think maybe my mom saw in me then that maybe I had something going on and I was serious about it. So yeah, she put me in for some guitar lessons down the street, and I saw this guy for a half an hour once a week. But she would, she'd take me to the guitar store. I got my first Les Paul from her. My mom was pretty influential in all of that stuff. But it wasn't until after I got sober that I actually finally took a serious vocal lesson, and that completely changed my life so many years down the road.
Yeah. And then what was the music scene like growing up in your area? When did you actually start playing out then?
The music scene, let's see. I think it was the first day in high school. As far as my brother and I had our little band that we would, we were trying to cover Who songs and I think Quiet Riot songs, and we were writing some original music. That was before, that was around the time I got into junior high. And then I was DJing in junior high, but it was really the first real band that I had. I think the first, I think the rumor just got out. I think I started being a self-proclaimed lead singer. I don't even know if I'd ever proven myself, but I remember first day of freshman year, coming to school, and there was this kid, Chris Little, was standing out in front of Chris Little. got two friends named Chris Little. I just thought of that. But anyway, he was standing out in front of school as I walked up, and he goes, "Hey, man, I think I heard you're a singer." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm a singer." And then he's like, "Cool. Well, I'm putting together a band. Let's jam." And I think the first jam we had was at the drummer's place, and we did like Seek and Destroy and some Metallica songs and some AC/DC covers, and that was like the first time I really felt like, wow, I'm in a band, and like everybody knew it. We all knew we were going to do. We were playing all the lunchtime, the lunchtime jams, and then we did like the proms and all that stuff. We started playing parties, my house. We were rehearsing at my house. That's when it got serious.
Nice. And then what was the name of that band?
Paragon. Pretty cool name.
Yeah. And then you guys started like when did you start like actually playing out in clubs? When going from the parties to clubs.
I don't think that band really hit any clubs. Maybe the place Britannia Arms. That was in Saratoga, California. It's kind of a small town, but where there was a band, Marquis de Sade, that rehearsed in a studio over on Stevens Creek towards San Jose. And so we'd get up and jam over there, but it was never like I'm just trying to think if we ever actually played a gig out, but not really clubs, but I would go to the Omni and the Stone and the Warfield. And I think we tried to catch Exodus and Metallica and Testament. All of those bands were really playing heavily up there. So it was more like I kind of went as a spectator to those clubs at that time. I wasn't really playing the clubs with that band. It wasn't until I really got to LA that everything started with like serious clubbing and touring happened almost immediately once I got down to LA around 17, 18 years old.
Okay. Yeah. And I remember, I've heard a little bit of your story, previously, but, when was it, when you get down to LA and, you're hitting more shows, there was a time that you, connected with Lemmy and Motorhead.
Yeah. So I probably got down here like 17, 18. I joined a band called Mondo Cane, and we started playing around town, like all the No Bozo jams. We were on the cover of a thing called Rock City News. We were opening for a lot of the big bands on the strip, playing the Whiskey, the Roxy, the Viper Room, which was the Central, I think, at the time, FM Station out in the Valley. There was Bar One up the street, and then, of course, Gazzari's, which turned into the Key Club. Let's see, it was probably a good two and a half years later that I actually finally met Lem. I had a few girlfriends. I've been running around town a lot. I've been writing a lot of music, still playing with Mondo Cane, but I think the first incarnation of Butterside had actually been, had been born. I started to write a lot of my own music, but still playing with other bands are a little bit more, ahead of that, playing the club circuits around here. But I got with a girl who was the camera woman for Lem. She was like she was just always carrying around a camcorder, and we were, that's when a lot of the dope stories start. I mean, actually the dope story started long before that. I don't know if that's where we're going with this entire story, but yeah, I ended up over to rehearsal of Motorhead's down on Santa Monica and Highland over there. There was a Rock and Roll Movers, and they had this big storage unit, and walked in and Motorhead was just cranking away, and I met Lem, and I was there for other reasons. I was dropping something off, but I think that day we got to talking about jewelry and stuff like that. And I told him that I'd studied jewelry in a jewelry class in high school, and he handed me like three or four dirt clods, and he said, "Here, clean these up and bring them back for me." And I took them home and I started cleaning them up on my jewelry machines, and beneath all of this mud was some bayonets from World War II, authentic, actual Nazi bayonets. So I got those polished up and looking like brand new, and I brought them back to his apartment. And at that point, I think we kind of locked in. I think he was super surprised, A, that I showed back up with everything he'd given me, and secondly, that I did a really good job. So I think that was the first time Lem invited me to sit in his apartment, and we played video games and looked through all of his guitars and started to really bond over everything and hung out. And, I think, I don't know, hard to separate me from him after that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what a legendary figure in the music world. And I remember, you know, you sharing a little bit about, you know, connecting with him. I think you roadied for him for a little while and stuff too.
Or... Yeah, too long after that that I was, Phil was over at our place and he was on the phone and his roadie couldn't make it overseas. There's a problem with his visa and he hung up the phone. He's like, yeah, damn, I don't have a roadie. I was like, yeah, you do. He's like, okay, sick, let's go.
Nice. And then, I mean, obviously that good, you know, before you get ready to start touring yourself with your band and everything, I mean, kind of gave you a tutorial on what to or maybe what not to do on the road.
All of the above. Yeah. It was thrown into the wolves, thrown into the fire and thrown into the big show. But I mean, what a finely tuned outfit that was, you know. I don't think I've ever seen something so... It's crazy how chaotic and how organized it was and is at the same time.
Awesome. And then you were saying that the with your band Mondo Cane, that you were kind of having the early incarnation of Butterside. When did Butterside come together for you? And I'm a name guy. I'm always curious. What inspired the name Butterside?
Well, at the time there was names that, you know, the big bands were like Korn and Limp Bizkit, you know, so I kind of had that headset, you know. I think I was kind of in that, I was kind of riding that wave. So coming up with a name like, you know, Fire from the Gods or like, you know, anything evil or like some name that just kind of pigeonholed you like everybody else, I think was just off the, it wasn't on the table. So, I had fucked up on a lyric. We were recording and I was trying to rhyme something. Actually, the song ended up becoming Genocide, one of the first singles off the first record. But this was really early on and we were recording the whole first improv session together with a few of the musicians that went on to perform the first real version of Butterside, Stone Man and Rich Sacco. And when we listened back, I flubbed a line and I said Butterside to rhyme with Genocide. And they were like, what the fuck is Butterside? I said, that's the fucking name of the band, bro. You know? And then fast forward years and years later, when Lem finally actually did say, let's get you in the studio and I'm going to sign you to Motorhead Music. And I said, well, I'm kind of thinking about changing the name. And he said, I like Butterside. You know? And I was like, okay, how can I argue with, you know, the you almighty? Can't.
Yeah, exactly. You can't.
Yeah. Yeah. A few tours later around the world and you've got t-shirts all over the place and stickers and people know your name, even if it's not the hugest audience, you feel like you've kind of, you know, you got to stick to it, you know, and it's funny. I think the most genius minds that I've met when I bring up the name, they really take to it. They love it right when they hear it, you know, and I'm always surprised to see that because so many people want to just give you hate about the name. And I just kind of, you know, my name's Patrick Stone. I had the perfect opportunity to just run with that. And it was just kind of like, I don't know. It's already an impossible road ahead of us. Let's just see if it's really meant to be, let's make it as hard as possible so that when it happens, we know it's for sure. We know it's supposed to happen. So, you know, it's insane. All of it's insane.
Oh yeah. It's like, you know, I mean, whatever, you know, our higher powers got planned for us, you know, it's like, you're going to, yeah. Trust the process.
Don't take yourself too seriously. I mean, I really have a lot of respect for bands that get these great names, you know. Sam always says, you know, when they ask Sam Colton, you know, what's the answer to that question? What's the Butterside name? He says, all the good names were taken.
Nice. And then you touched a little bit on you know, and only, you know, share, you know, whatever, if you're comfortable talking about it, but you mentioned, you know, getting sober. You know, I mean, that's kind of how we connected. You know, I just celebrated 15 years on Friday. So, it's been an awesome, awesome journey to be a part of and get to know people like you. But it, you know, if you're, comfortable sharing, like want to talk about like, you know, when, maybe when it started and, you know, getting sober for you.
Yeah. 15 years, is that nonstop? Did it take you a couple times or did you quit.
This is nonstop, man. So far, I mean, this is my first run, you know, and I don't plan on doing I'm hoping. My big struggle is now it's just like sugar, you know. I got to apply the program to sugar and sweets and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But alcohol, it's been 15 years, man.
Yeah, good for you, man. Yeah, same with me. I mean, I had a touched by God moment. That's all there is to it. I mean, by the time I got to LA, I was already, just doing speed all day. The drugs and stuff happened. It was just part of the gig. It would seem like it was just, it needed to be on the resume. I mean, I fell in love with Jim Morrison. I think that was the one I left off the list earlier. I mean, I think he was, definitely, at least for a long period of time, he was my number one influence. And I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted to be legendary like him, I want my grave to be the most visited gravesite in history. Like his is. I just went to his gravesite in Paris when I was there at Christmas break. And, it was like, in order to be taken that seriously or be able to convey a message that was as profound as his, I felt like I really needed to test the limits of my mind and my spirituality. So drug addiction was something that I felt was necessary to, just like the name, to challenge myself and say, if this is meant to be, then I'm going to be okay. I had a lot of faith, I guess, maybe unknown faith at that point that I could slam six times a day and think that I was going to live through it was insane. But that's how bad it got, I mean, the drinking probably started, like I said, at parties with my parents. They never thought it was an issue because neither of them ever suffered from addiction. They could go out and drink and come home and then that was it. They just had a good time. I think I saw my mother drunk once. I think she came home from a party once and she was maybe once. My father, I never saw drunk. He might have a, black Russian or a white Russian or something at night. He was never, I never saw him even, I don't even think I ever saw my father tipsy, but so it just, they weren't scared of it. It wasn't something they were worried about. And then I was just off and down that path. And I think my sister being such a big influence, I lost her when I was 12 years old, she committed suicide. And then everything kind of shifted and changed. And I felt like I was kind of trying to find an escape. So I started smoking pot and hanging out with those kind of kids, any excuse to ditch school and stop being looked at like I felt like I was, which was probably all in my own head. But a lot of the demons started seeping in at the same time. So I feel like I thought I was running from those demons, but in fact, I was actually, nurturing them by starting to smoke pot. And then I started doing acid and then, the whole family fell apart. And I thought it was a good idea to sell drugs. And I got caught with some, and then I got kicked out of the state of California. And I was in some probation, program out in bumfuck nowhere. And I learned through some biker friends of mine that were making biker speed in their bathtub how to avoid getting caught with Golden Seal that they made. And here I was just being enabled to keep going and keep going and keep going. And I just kept coming more and more of a criminal, to be honest, and more of an addict. And by the time I hit Los Angeles, I'd never tried crack before. But the first place I moved, the entire street, Hobart Street there in between Sunset and Hollywood over by Jumbo's where I first moved, was just nothing but crack central. I think I left the apartment the first time to go get some groceries and never made it to Food for Less. I met some guy on the street was like, "Hey, you wanna get high?" He hands me a crack pipe, I was like, it was gone. All of my savings went into that. The two guys that I moved down to LA with, I think ran home with their tails between their legs, and I was here alone, smoking crack. But I did manage to get into a band, and I was, I was in that band Mondo Cane, and then, gosh, by the time I was 19, I started slamming dope. I met somebody that talked me into it. I never thought I would do needles, and then, the whole time I was with Motorhead, I think I kept it a secret. Maybe they knew, maybe they didn't. I mean, they could look in my eyes and tell how fucked up I was, but I definitely was on that path. I wanted to be Jim Morrison. So I was, just completely fucked up for many, many, many years. I continued to do a lot of songwriting. It's not that there weren't a lot of great things that came out of those times, but I was spiraling downward for a long time and convincing myself that it was cool. And then, you know, years and years and years later, I finally think I got kicked out of the last girlfriend's place I was living at, and I was on the streets and I was homeless and scraping change together, but managing to keep, you know, somehow drug addicts managed to keep their dope addiction up even higher than they'd had it before. I mean, it did not slow me down in my intake, but I think I finally had it. I was suicidal, managed to get one of these, a motel room up here at the 777 on La Brea and Franklin. And I was trying to do myself in, and I think I was really ready to do it. I had enough dope in the rig to kill myself. I didn't have a friend left on the planet, I don't think, really. Maybe one guy, and that was probably the one guy I called after I had my touched by God moment. But I had the rig registered, and I was full of tears, and I was like 125 pounds. I'm 6'3", so I was just dead already. I was dead. I just wanted to die, and I was getting ready to hit it. And the phone rang, and on my little Motorola flip phone was my dad's area code. And I hadn't spoken to my father or my mother or anybody in my family for a long, long time. So that area code, I was just like, what? Who's calling me from that area code? So I pick up the phone, and it was my dad's neighbor had stopped by the apartment to return some Tupperware. And it was random. I think after talking to him later, he said that was just like, it had been 6 months since he'd seen her. Talked to my father, even though he only lived a few apartments down, but it was random that he went to return his Tupperware. But I answer the phone. He says, hey, this is your dad's neighbor, Lance. Your dad's having a heart attack. Do you want to talk to him? I was like, what? And I've described this a few times, but like my whole world was like, it was like I was underwater for probably a decade, it felt like, you know? It was like everything was blurry and majorly vivid colors and kind of slow motion, and everything kind of had an echo to it. That was my life, like constantly, you know. I mean, I would stay up for days and days and days, and when I'd wake up, maybe there was a bit of clarity, but I went straight back to getting high. So it was just this underwater feeling for so long. And in that moment, it was like the ocean parted, or there was like this little circle of clarity, kind of this fear that kind of opened up in my world. And he put my father on the phone, and all I could hear was this choking. It was, ah, ah, ah. And then Lance gets back on the phone, and he says, listen, I don't know if your dad's going to make it. I've called the paramedics. They're on the way, but like, you might want to get up here. And we hang up the phone. And that little window of clarity, kind of like, I grabbed that last guitar that I had in that room. I ran down to the pawn shop and pawned it. My buddy Aaron picked me up and took me to the airport. I got on a flight. On the way there, they said that my father had survived the heart attack. He was at Carson, but now he's having a major stroke. So still seriously, you know, 10% chance he was going to live, but they're flying him by helicopter to Reno, which actually got him closer to where I was going to land. So landed in Reno. Lance picked me up from the airport, took me to the hospital, and I found my father there with staples from his eyebrow all the way back to his spine. They'd cut open his head and done brain surgery to relieve the blood and the pressure. And he was in a coma. So I kind of buckled and started praying. That was a crazy, crazy thing to find myself praying to whatever it was that I felt I was praying to. But long story short, you know, back and forth from his house back to the hospital, and slowly but surely he came back, and I'd made all promises to God that I would never go back to my wicked ways. I would accomplish all the things he put me on this planet to do if he would just spare my father and spare me, and he did both of those things for me, and I've just kept my promises ever since.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember hearing that story and like really felt the connection. You know, I lost someone close to me to suicide early on, and that like spiraled me into the worst parts of my addiction. And thankfully, you know, I'd gotten sober a couple of years before my dad ended up passing, and being able to like make those amends, you know, and have a great relationship with him, say all the things I needed to say to him before he passed. And, you know, and what also, you know, has inspired me about your story is where you're at with your faith today. And, you know, like, I think you had shared going on to like using your musical talents in worship and stuff. Yeah. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, when we bring that subject up, there's always this, you know, there's this slope that I know I'm about to go down. I feel like my voice changes even when I start explaining that story, because it's so, it's, you know, I'm actually surprised I got through it without getting really teared up, because, you know, I guess I just kind of get used to telling the story, and it just becomes kind of like a muscle memory thing. But it's just such a scary, horrible place. And it's so hard to believe all these years later that that's where it got to, because all of the magical and beautiful and wonderful things that have happened since then, you know, happened in that moment, you know. My relationship like yours, and God bless that for you and your father to reconnect like that, because that's probably, you know, my relationship with my mother and my father and my brother that has come back because of all of that. I had 14 great years with my father, and I would go visit him, you know, once or twice a year, and we had all these Christmases together. And, you know, he started his kind of downward, like he actually came, I wouldn't say he came all the way back from his heart attack and his stroke, but well enough that we had like 14 great years together where we spent a lot of time reconnecting and building a bond that was just unbreakable. And my mom and I now have this relationship that's like, I mean, she's my best friend. You know, we just went to, you know, spent 3 weeks in Europe together for Christmas, and I've never had so much fun. And my brother and I too, just the respect that came back from that whole thing. You know, I've always wanted to be respected by my brother, and I don't think I really ever had that until after I got clean. But yeah, all of these, you know, these signs just kept happening. Like, it was just so obvious that this was the change that I needed to make my entire life. You know, I had all of these gifts, and I wasn't honing them and sharpening them like I did once I got clean. It was just insane. I kept getting acting gig after acting gig. Like, I just went into acting because it was like background work seemed like a simple way to kind of pay the bills. And, you know, I got back from once I felt like my father was doing well enough, I finally came back to LA, and that was my plan. I'm just going to become a background actor, and I'll be able to get an apartment and take care of myself and start focusing on music again. And like, I was in town for maybe 3 days, and I landed a featured role as a background guy on Deadwood, which was my favorite show. You know, we used to sit in the drug den when I was getting high with all of my druggy friends, watching Deadwood every week, and we would snort a line every time they said cocksucker, and we would take a shot every time they said motherfucker, which was like 20 times a show. So by the time the show was over, we were so fucked up. It was crazy. Like, the party was insane. And then fast forward to the flip side of this, maybe a couple months after that same ritual, there I was filming the show and making friends with the producer, who ended up having me be on the next show that he did, this surfing thing down by the Mexican border. And to become friends with people like W. Earl Brown, is just a phenomenal actor in Star Wars and Deadwood and a million other things. And then to be surrounded by Alice in Chains, and to bring Lemmy down to the set where we were filming Deadwood, and, you know, Anthrax was there, all of them, ZZ Top, everybody wanted to be on the show. And here I was getting high 1 month, and then the next month I'm in this surreal environment. And it was like, what the hell is happening? Like, why are you being so good to me? I was so bad. I was all of these sins. I didn't want to live anymore. And here I am making tons of cash, doing all of this really cool shit. And it was, you know, one thing led to another too. I met the makeup artist from that show, and she wanted to offer me a place. And in doing so, she took me to church, and then I met the pastor, and his music connected with me so hard that I started offering up my services for church, and then they would use me when he wasn't available. So all of a sudden I'm leading worship at church, and that started in like a movie theater with like maybe a congregation of 15 people. And by the time that finished, 2 or 3 years later, before I finally moved away from Santa Clarita, out there filming the Deadwood thing, you know, I was leading worship 4 times a day in a congregation of 2,000 people. So to watch that whole thing expand and grow. And by then I'd done a couple of commercials, and like, you know, I made $85,000 in one day doing a damn commercial one time, you know? And it was like, I can do anything I want. Like, what do I want to do? And by that time I started dating a girl who was, you know, producing movies with, you know, the guy that was producing the Oscars, and I went to the Oscars. Like, all this crazy shit was happening, you know? And it was just obvious. Every day I woke up, there was this glow inside of like this, I was given this gift that like, I felt like life always should have been, but I couldn't figure out how to get it. And it just became very obvious to me that, you know, sobriety was a huge key for me, because I felt like my purpose was obvious every morning, you know, and I could feel it every time I drive down to Mexico doing that show, or, you know. And then my life got completely, also the balance was super chaotic and beautiful at the same time. I mean, I was bartending at a strip club, so there was that whole world. And I would lead worship at church, you know, 4 times in the morning, and then I would drive to the strip club and bartend at night. So there was this super balance of good and evil happening. I mean, the debauchery and the goodness. So it was like I still really started to develop my own personal character and personality, like started really defining itself. But after I had enough money in the bank, I really started saying to myself, well, let's start focusing on my music. And also that led to, you know, auditions with Quiet Riot, which led to the auditions with Steven Adler. So there I am, all of a sudden I'm singing for my hero, you know, Steven Adler from Guns N' Roses, my favorite band. By the time I came to LA, that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be Guns N' Roses. And there, here I am singing for Steven Adler and touring the world. And of course, the Quiet Riot auditions had led to which we brought up before, the first lesson I actually took from Ron Anderson changed my entire technique and like actually made me into a professional singer, to where I actually got through that audition and picked to be the singer for Steven's band. It was just like one thing after the other. It was just undeniable that like I was finally on a path of purpose, you know? So
yeah,
and it's just, you know, all of the stories that have happened since then. I mean, that's just a snippet. I mean, all of those stories I just told you from the time I got clean to that was only like 2012, and here we are 2024. Can you imagine all of the things that have happened in between then and now? And I'm telling you, it just gets more magical the more you tell the story.
Oh yeah. And it's funny too, because you had me thinking before we went on, we were talking about Star Wars and your collection and everything, and you know, there's like, you know, the Jedi and the Sith, you know, and then you were kind of living in both worlds. And if you read like the books and the canon, there's like the gray Jedi who's like the balanced in between both. And it's like you were the gray Jedi for a while, it sounds like, from the strip club, from worship to the strip club, you know. Yeah.
The gray Jedi. Sorry, I'm a total nerd. Yeah. No, yeah, I've definitely found a balance. I've had a few sponsees over the years, and it was funny. I was at a meeting the other night, and I saw this guy speaking, and he was full of tears in his eyes, and he was you know, he was just at his, he's at the end, you know. He feels like he's at the end. He just relapsed, and he was talking about how hard the fourth step was, and I looked up, you know, at the wall, and I see the fourth step and taking moral inventory, and I laughed for the first time, because that's kind of the step where everybody gets so scared, you know. It's, yeah, like, and to be honest, it was the first time I've laughed at it. And the only reason I laugh at it is because now I think I'm finally so comfortable with, you know, my shortcomings and my, you know, the parts of us that like you try to hide, you know. I've learned from my experiences now to be unapologetically myself, you know. I've got to respect the parts of me, the things that might upset other people. As long as I'm honest about them, then, you know, it's okay if you don't like that. And I don't need you to like, I don't need everybody to like me, you know, I just need to like myself. And I've come to really accept, you know, the good and the bad that comes with being human, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing too, is like, you know, like our program calls for rigorous honesty. And sometimes my honesty might not, you know, you might not be, you know, line up with your honesty or what you're willing to hear or want to hear, but hey, man, just being honest, you know?
Yeah.
That's the life I got to live, you know? And, yeah. and you know, I still like 15 years later, you know, well, sometimes I'll still struggle with that, you know, worrying about like what others are thinking or trying to, you know, keep everybody, you know, there's some, yeah, my mom just had a surgery this week. I was there to be a service to help her out, but it's like, you know, I can't just be rigorously honest, you know, in front of my mom about stuff still, you know? And, but I'm, you know, like I mentioned, this new relationship, she just keeps pulling me into being my authentic self. Just be who you are. I don't want you to put on a mask or pretend for me for this relationship. Just be who you are, you know? And so I am. And sometimes it's, you know, it leads us to having to communicate through and work out a few things, you know, but I'm just being, you know, myself, like you asked me to be, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, my mom's the same way, but I mean, I think I don't know if she really cares for it a lot of the time, but I know she respects it, you know, that I'm, you know, she knows everything about me. It's the best, you know, it's like, it's the best.
And what it sounds like too, is just like, you know, like we can hold ourselves up and keep ourselves from receiving the blessings that we're supposed to have when we fall off that balance, when we're too far to the left or too far to the right, instead of narrow and straight through the path, you know? And it sounds like when you're sticking to the path and being who you're called to be, no matter who it may upset on either side, you know, the blessings have been coming for you, man. So that's inspiring for me. I just got to stir back to center, you know, and just love who I am, man.
Amen, Bill. I could never have said it better myself. I mean, you know, and I think that's it's a beautiful thing. You and I share the same thing. I meet so many people that fall off. I just never could understand that. And I know that we're lucky. You and I are two very lucky people that we were, again, just lucky enough to catch it on the first ride, you know, because, it's a beautiful thing to be able to see things that way, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure, man. For sure. And I'm a student for life in this game, man. I'm always learning, you know, the more one of the old timers at one of my local meetings says, you know, the more I learn, the less I know, you know?
Yeah. 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 We can't,
You know, talk about some of the blessings that we both share in this journey. I know, you know, one of the blessings is we both have a mutual friend, Mr. Matt Pinfield.
Yeah.
And you got to like do the theme music for his show Power Hour. How Isn't did that like, come together for you?
That's the sickest thing ever. I'm not, there's nothing in my life I'm more grateful for other than maybe my mom, my family, you know, than Matt Pinfield. You know, he's I have to pinch myself constantly because, you know, he was such a legendary figure, you know, to walk into my studio one day and see him excited about my music was like it was an out of body experience, you know, because, you know, I would watch TV and just be like, God, man, these guys, they have what I want. I don't have that. You know, it sounds like such a long road that they took to get to where they are. And they have all this respect because they've done all these magical things. And to have this legendary figure walk into your studio and, you know, especially starting off the friendship for the right reasons, you know, you want somebody like that in your life because they like your music, they respect your music. And to have that just out of the way off the top, it was just like, you know, because I see him as like, you know, at that point, I still feel like I'm desperate at times, you know, maybe other musicians feel this way too. And I'm guessing some of them still feel this way when they get to the top. I mean, I think that maybe that's something I'll carry forever, that I have this desperation to me because I always, I want more. I want my life to mean more. I want my purpose to mean more. I want my music to mean more. I want my lyrics to mean more. I want to mean more to the world, you know? I want to, because I've been through so much struggle. I know I've felt so much pain. And to have Matt's respect is definitely validation. And yet at the same time, it was, I think, the second or third time that he'd come to visit after hearing our music. He came to see us a couple more times after that. And we were in the parking lot one night and he was going home and we connected on sobriety. Our good friend Renee was there too. And that's, I was lucky enough that those beautiful human beings allowed me into this. There was just a tiny little circle. There was four guys talking. I think Howie was there, Howie Weinberg and Renee and Matt. And I think I'd run out to the parking lot because it was, Matt had come and gone a few times and this was it. He walked out of the studio at NRG with Jay Baumgartner. And I was like, I'm not going to let Matt get away this time. Like, I want to get his number and I want to hang out with him. I feel like we could be friends. And I run out to the parking lot and he's getting ready to go home. And I think the conversation was something about the program, you know? And I think I caught that much of the conversation and they weren't afraid to let me into that little conversation there. And when they did, I looked at Matt in the eye and I said, Matt, I think at the time I had like 14 years. And I said, Matt, I got 14 years sober if you ever want to hang out. And I think we exchanged numbers that time. We started talking, you know, I think we got on a phone call and we talked about his father and his father was a Marine and my dad was a Marine. And we just started connecting on a real personal level. I think we had a lot of the same views on politics, which was hilarious. We had a lot of laughs about that. And just a real beautiful friendship started to explode. And then he had his accident, you know, and I felt compelled to go and see him. And I remember I brought him an iPad and stuff just so he'd keep his mind off of his, rehabilitation from such a horrible accident. Then watching that whole chapter of his life unfold. And that was his time. He was finally touched by God. And from that moment on, he's had that powerful glow inside of him. And we've shared that glow together. Gosh, we get together three or four times a week, you know, we'll hang out. And
I see you guys hitting the gym together and everything. And
going to dinner. And like the whole time, I've just been, you know, I've known the whole time that's something that not everybody gets. And, you know, I've always tried to make, you know, it's never been about asking Matt for anything. It's just about being so blessed to sit at a table and sit at a table and hear these stories, you know, story, knowing that they're not lies, knowing that this is like, you're getting this from the source, you know, Matt just keeps coming to he'll just show up wherever we're going and he'll be like, hey man, I'm putting you on the radio, or hey man, let's get you on the countdown, or hey man, let's bring you to this show and let's get you to meet these guys. And it's just like one thing after the other. And I think Matt has, he's found, I bring a lot to the table from another angle. I hope, you know, I feel that that's the only reason that he rewards me with all of the love that he does, is because I do give him a lot of love. And I know we just reciprocate that, you know? But yeah, we got, the Power Hour started on a Twitch countdown. Just him and his laptop and his couch, but he brought Burnside to the table. And then I was bringing, 50 to 100 of my fans to every countdown and they would vote. And we got to the top of the countdown. So I think we had championed that chart, four or five times before Katie Babs and Josh were brought onto the show. And at that point, I came into the studio that they were doing the whole thing at Danny Wimmer, and that's when Josh and Matt asked me to do the countdown, and I came back with Butterside just delivered a monster of a track, and they couldn't deny that was definitely supposed to be the soundtrack for their TV show. So that's how that whole thing happened.
Awesome. Yeah, Matt, man, he's honored me with being a guest on my show here, My dad was a Marine, World War II Marine, invasion of Okinawa. So we have a lot in common. Yeah, have so much in common, man. And Matt inspiration to me as well. Like, I grew up, like, I remember as a kid, like, you know, with a tape recorder, kind of like recording, making up my own shows, recording my own shows. I'd watch Johnny Carson and stuff interviewing people as a kid. And I always kind of wanted to do that. And unfortunately, I didn't get the, I guess, the support at home. I had the people, in a loving way, wanting me to take the safe route, you know, through, you know, you got to get a job, you got to do this, or go, you know, I joined the military and whatever. But, you know, a lot of insecurities over time. And now here I am, I'm going to be 51 this month. And I'm an old dude finally pursuing my dream, doing this podcast. And it's not, you know, it's not, there's nothing monetary or whatever. It's just, it's therapy for me. It's part of my healing, my sharing, you know, in recovery, and also from my time in the military over my anxieties and PTSD and whatever, you know. This is just a fun thing. But I would, you know, one of my dreams and goals is to sometime maybe, you know, be a part of that Power Hour with Matt, you know, and Danny Wimmer and stuff. Like, let me be the veteran correspondent or something like that, you know, occasionally come on. So I pitched it to Matt before, but, you know, we'll see what happens. I'll just, whatever God's got planned, he'll make happen. But that's awesome that you guys did the theme song for that. And then also, I was checking out your video, Good for Nothing, which was like watching the Road Warrior, like a Road Warrior movie or something like that. It's pretty badass. And how you treated our boy Matt and that, I don't know, man. But that was a pretty sick movie. You want to, it was like a movie, the music video, but you want to talk a little bit about that song and putting that video together?
Hell yeah. First of all, yeah. You know, my heroes are, you know, the same age. You know, Corey Taylor's out there fucking killing it. You know, it's probably the hardest working dude in the industry and one of the most successful. And, you know as well as I do, if you just focus every day, you know, don't worry about yesterday, don't worry about tomorrow, work on today. And if that's your dream and that's your goal and that's what you're pursuing, you take one step towards those things, there's no reason in the world why you can't end up exactly where you want to be. And I wouldn't count you out for any of that. So good luck, and I'll be rooting for you with all
Thanks,
of those.
Brother. Things.
And yeah, it's funny to mistreat Matt in the video. Like, it's the exact opposite of how I'd actually treat him in real life, because I just put him on pillows and give him hugs and kisses. But yeah, I slit his throat on the back of a Harley Davidson. And yeah, that video, you know, amateurs borrow. That's what Jay Baumgartner told me. Amateurs borrow, professional steal, you know. So when it came to the Mad Max video, I watch a lot of my heroes. Look at, you know, Spencer from Ice Nine and all of his entire world of lore that he's created with the horror movie stuff. It's like, why not borrow and steal from something that really inspires you? And I thought, what could be crazier than a guy with, you know, without any backing like myself, to create something that spectacular? So it was my biggest bite off of the apple I could chew to come up with that idea of a Road Warrior Mad Max kind of a chase, you know, car chase through a apocalyptic sandstorm. And you know, it definitely had its challenges. We started filming that video long before we did The Truth or Joker or Power Hour. We shot that one, and then the process of adding the visual effects and making it realistic and cool took over a year to do that, but definitely worth it. It's funny too, because you know, a lot of the other views have done a lot better on YouTube, only because this one was banned. You put all your work into something that gets censored and banned, and it's kind of makes you want to cry because you put so much into it, and the violence is the best part of it.
Yeah.
You know, you know, to have, you know, the world in the state that it's in, I mean, I understand why they want to ban guns and violence and stuff like that. But yeah, YouTube's putting a huge cripple on the video, but it still sits on Apple Music in its full uncensored splendor. So you can still see it there. So
I watched it. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's cool. I'm really proud of it. It's something that will sit there. They will take the ban off in a little while. I think once the ad campaigns stop, that you'll find they have it on YouTube uncensored again. But yeah, it's something to see. If you haven't seen it, go and check it out. It's wild.
Oh yeah, for sure. I highly recommend it. And yeah, I've had some interviews banned on YouTube. So it's like, yeah, it's a tough, tough battle sometimes, you know, over there. You know, that's why I have some of the other channels I'm on, you know. But because I'm just having conversations like we're having here. But, you know, if people want to talk about certain topics that I guess are, you know, aren't PC or whatever, it's I don't know. It's a whole nother thing, man. I'm a guy that served, and I serve for everybody to have a voice, you know, and yeah. I don't have to like what everybody has to say half the time, but I appreciate their speaking, you know, and I'm not one of the ones to try and cancel or censor things that I'm not comfortable with, you know. It's like everybody yeah. has a voice, you know.
Yeah, freedom of speech.
Yeah. And then so I was going down like kind of like the rabbit hole of some of the music videos and songs that I was enjoying. And Never Worth It, I really enjoyed the video, but also the song. And I'm curious about like the message that you're sending out or the story you're telling with that.
You know, it's kind of a balance between it was the song ultimately was about heroin, to be honest. And if you could give her a face, you know, and make her the most attractive thing to you that you've ever seen, you know, not to be, you know, yeah, there, it's funny. There's this, I've already now forgotten her name on Instagram. I was obsessed with this, this girl's visuals. She's like, you know, she has the tongue that's cut down the middle. She's got piercings and she's just this, she's like a monster, you know, but she was really sexy at the same time. And she's a tattoo artist and she does all this stuff. Well, she looks like an alien and she just had these wild pictures on Instagram. And I remember obsessing over her, just looking at her. And that kind of brought the lyrics kind of started to flow as I was looking at her, just thinking about, you know, the first lyric is I want what's beautiful to me. And I also couldn't get her attention. I was messaging her and trying to get her attention and talk to her. And I was like, I'm writing this song. And like, I want you to, she lived in the UK. And I was like, I don't care how much it costs. I want you to fly over here and be a part of the video. And the video at first, the idea was that we were going to have this lake of blood and everything was going to be a black and red aesthetic. And then I wanted her to come out from under the water and actually kill all the band members off during the video. This big scorpion tail kind of a thing coming from behind her, but I couldn't get the chick to respond. So I'm writing the lyrics and I was looking at her face, but in turn to get, you know, the process of writing lyrics for me, especially in the company of Matt Good, becomes a very, like it has to be super honest and authentic. So I had to connect beyond a physical attraction. I had to, what would make me so obsessed with something? And that came back to the needle and the heroin, and that's where the lyrics and the, you know, the needle to the vein is the part of the chorus is, you know, this obsession with something that's so beautiful. And of course, life is so beautiful once you've gone under, you know, the influence of that drug, that it becomes a sexual obsession. It's like beyond any relationship you could ever have with a woman or any other person. So it became this kind of a, it's a really dark, dark love affair, you know, this everything that you could ever want and not being able to have, like getting a taste of it and wanting more and more. And I think the video really actually came out super cool. I remember the movie Jaws, I was obsessed with that. You never actually saw the monster until the very end. And that's what made you so scared. So, you know, yeah. You have the claws coming out of the blood in the beginning of the video and there's just kind of this element of something around you is there. I love that song so much. I think the video really turned out really cool. It's just, my buddy Dylan came up with that outfit. He cut an entire suit in half and then sewed it back together, the whole Frankenstein thing. It's just, it means a lot to all of us in the band for sure, beyond its aesthetic. It's a very deep song.
Yeah, yeah. And then another song that I enjoyed was Ghost Lighting. And of course the video was a lot of fun with the Scooby-Doo cosplay or whatever you guys did with that, but that was a lot of fun, but it's like I'm also like, you know, gone through like relationships where I've been like gaslit. So I've been learning a lot about gaslighting and, you know, and so I see the play on words there. You want to, but am I reading too much in, or you want to share what was the message with that?
No, so, you nailed it. You know, you absolutely nailed it. Quick question. Do you edit this afterwards? You're gaslighting them. It's like you're ghostlighting yourself. So yeah. Yeah. And then ghost, of course, ghost just led to the wild idea that we had. We were out, I think we were in Tahoe shooting the Voices video, and we started talking about shooting the next one, and the Scooby-Doo idea came up, and we all were just like, let's give that a whack. And it's funny that intro to that music video is like a minute long, and gosh, it's the biggest, every time I watch it, it's the biggest learning experience. Because as a, you know, kind of as a director and a screenwriter and, you know, everything that I put into the making of our videos, I can see how far I've come, especially if you watch Ghostlighting and then you watch the newest one, Good for Nothing. You can tell that, like, I just learned a lot from that first intro. I mean, while I love the video and how corny it is, the pace of it doesn't quite move as fast as I'd like it to. And yet I think now I've really figured out that, you know, such an important part of putting the videos together is cutting out the parts you don't need, you know? You don't need that much to let the story move along. So
you do your own editing for those?
I work hand in hand with the editors. Yeah. I mean, I'm hands on 110% from the beginning to the end of those things. It's usually something that comes out of my mind. Ghostlighting was a little bit of a collab because Gabe Maska was, just he had that crazy sense of humor, got us all kind of psyched up about that idea. So, you know, but it was his idea to do a Scooby-Doo themed video. But the entire script and like the soundboard, I created the whole script, and I usually do that with all of our stuff. Yeah.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah, because I'm pretty much self-run here, and I do the audio editing, and I learned how to do that myself. I'm just getting into video now, but I'm just curious, like, what you use or what, you know.
I'm not sure. I do hire editors. I definitely hire. I wouldn't leave it in my own hands to do like the technical work, you know. But there's always like once I hand it over to the editor. Well, first it all starts with a storyboard, and I'll just go ahead and I'll type out everything that's going to happen. So you see the words on the screen of what you will actually be seeing in the end, along to the music. You know, I do that. It's just like a verbal storyboard, which explains everything that's going to happen in the video. And then we go and create a picture storyboard, and then we shoot the thing, and then we bring it to the editor, and then he can follow that storyboard to find all of the pieces, the best takes of whatever to fit that verbal storyboard. And then he'll send it over, and then I'll review it and then kind of agree or disagree or make suggestions until it's perfect, you know?
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another class I need to start taking, you know, because I'm self-run here. I don't got like, you know, the Joe Rogan crew or nothing like that, but yeah, it's something that I, you know, I'm enjoying. So might as well go all in, do the best I can do with it, you know?
It's funny nowadays, you know, gosh, people are making, you know, stuff on TikTok and Instagram and everything else. That's, you know, it's almost like just part of us to get good at that now. You know, people are editing all of their own stuff on their phones. It's just, I think, you know, the next run, I think I might give it a whack myself, you know, save myself some cash, because it's the technology's come so far that it's, you know, if you start thumbing around with it, it's pretty fun actually to create a lot of content and edit it yourself.
Yeah. My girlfriend's, she's a bit younger than me, and she's been on me about doing that. You know, you got to do more. I mean, you're kind of boring, you know. I'm like, all right, well, thanks. So I just never felt like people wanted to hear what I had to say. That's why I have others on to hear their story and stuff. But I guess I got to get used to like walking around my phone and just like doing like little updates. Hey, this week we're going to have, you know, or whatever, you know. So whatever it takes, man, I guess I'll start doing it, you know.
If we can get, you know, I'd love to ask you questions as well. I mean, I love it when interviews are, you know, two-sided, you know, because it's like, it's funny how many times, you know, I feel like sometimes I'm telling the same story over and over again. And the only thing that changes is the person I'm being interviewed by. So it's always great to have somebody who's got a story of their own. And 15 years sober, man, that's, you know, you've got a story that, you know, I'm sure that if you start opening up about it, it's just as interesting as mine, you know?
Yeah, I would say I've done a few things here in Cleveland, you know, with, and I've been involved in music for a number of years. I used to be a concert promoter here and stuff. So, you know, there's definitely some stories, man. And I'm just like, you know, come to God moment, I guess, was basically, you know, when I went on my last deployment, it was like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know, go to a dry country, dry out, and, you know, you come home, have that last blackout and realize that's not what you want to do anymore. And your little girls are like, Daddy, we don't want to see you like that anymore, you know? And it, there was a lot of factors, you know, seeing friends go home in boxes, you know, and that could have been you, and like, what legacy would you have left behind? You know, a lot of things. It was like a perfect storm for me. But what was amazing is why I was over there on my last deployment too. I would volunteer to, you know, like we had our job and the things we would do, but, you know, I liked, cause I, you know, downtime was the worst because then I just was thinking about home, thinking about my little girls, missing home, going crazy. So I'd volunteer to do a lot of stuff. So being the music guy that I was, anytime we'd have musicians come play our bass with the Armed Forces Entertainment, I would volunteer to be security. You know, let me do security. Let me do something, you know, so I can get in there. And I had I was blessed that Everclear came and played. And that's where I met Art for the first time. And, you know, I think some seeds were planted during our conversation there as well, you know.
Hell yeah.
So
what bass?
I was at Camp Arif John in Kuwait.
In Kuwait, holy shit.
Yeah.
So a lot of action over there, huh?
Nah, it wasn't as much as like up in Iraq with a lot of other guys were facing around that time frame or Afghanistan. But, you know, we would see like the after effects because we would handle like the equipment and all that stuff that would come through or go up to that area and everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We, my buddy, rest in peace, Alan Steelgrave, took us on a USO tour and we went over and played Rammstein and a couple other bases around there. And it was
nice.
Saw a lot of people, you know, just, you know, these people, some of the people would come from being injured, you know, people would show up without legs.
Yeah. The hospital there.
Horrible things that had happened to them. And we would play for these people, you know? So major respect for your service and for all of those friends of yours that, didn't make it, you know?
Yeah,
that's crazy, and that's so great that you turned your life around for your daughters. I mean, how many daughters?
I got two, and now they're young women, man. They're both in their 20s, you know.
Wow.
So from my oldest turned 8 while I was over there, and you know, so a majority of their young lives they got to see me sober, you know, because I pretty much got sober after I came home. My last blackout was my welcome home party in like January of 2009. And then my sobriety date's March 1st, 2009. So, you know,
awesome.
So, but, you guys are going to have a, you know, pretty busy summer. It looks like, as well, getting ready to hit the road with, the 69 Eyes. And then, of course, we were mentioning Danny Wimmer earlier and Matt and everybody with the Power Hour. But Danny Wimmer Presents, you guys are going to be playing a couple of his festivals, I think. But Louder in Life and Aftershock this year.
Hell yeah. We were lucky enough to do Welcome to Rockville last year. And just watching your Spotify numbers go up by about 2,000 followers in a half an hour was pretty insane. That's the coolest thing about being invited to do these. At least the coolest thing I've seen so far is just, you know, it's just such a huge platform and such an honor to be on a list of so many legendary groups. You know, I think we played with Tool that time and Slipknot played the night we were there. And I mean, like it's a dream come true. And then to have a audience in front of you that's that massive, and then to see the results instantly of how many people get turned on to your music in such a quick time, you know, so it's just so cool. And I'm really looking forward to the 69 Ice tour as well, because I've had a thing for goth and underground music like that for a long time. And I try to incorporate it into our music, but we're metal, we're rock, but it's definitely a part of my character that I really am excited to explore playing for an audience like the 69 Eyes. And I hope that our fan base grows into something a little, for lack of a better word, darker, you know, a little bit of a darker following. Cause I love that whole vibe. So I hope that influences our music. I hope that, we get to play for, you know, huge audiences every night and gain a lot of fans. It's going to be a really exciting year. It's funny too, because I didn't have any of the resources going into 2024 that I did before. I've been really good about, making a lot of money and being able to pour it all into the band. And coming into 2024, I couldn't really see how any of it was going to happen. And I think I got, again, through the program and sobriety and by faith, just finally saying, fuck it, you know, why not? This year, I'm going to say yes to everything, and I'm going to get on the phone and just, you know, walk the walk and talk the talk and convince everybody that, like, this is the year that we do as much as you can possibly do. And here we are going into a tour that I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to pull off, you know, financially. How am I going to come up with the funds to make it all happen? And here we are. I mean, we're a couple weeks out, and I've never been so excited. Everything's falling into place. It's just like, you know, have the balls to do what your purpose and what your passion is, and follow it with all of your heart. And it's magical to see all the people that come out of the woodworks and support you and love you and help you.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm definitely excited for that tour. Like we were talking previously, you'll be hitting my neck of the woods on that tour, March 28th. You guys will be playing here at the Winchester in Lakewood, Ohio, which is, so I'm excited about that. We can meet in person, and, I get to check out Butterside live in the flesh, you know. And then, talking about, you know, like I said, once again, the Danny Wimmer festivals, getting to play that again this year. I've been going to those for a number of years now, done media down when it was Rock on the Range in Columbus, and now it's called Sonic Temple. And now he's partnered with my buddy Dan Jansen with the Incarceration Festival here in Ohio. So, you know, I hit those pretty regularly, and always just such a great time. It's like, you know, I'm such a music fan, and with everything that I've kind of, you know, gone through in my transition, being sober, and then, you know, but then dealing with, like, you know, the anxiety and PTSD, you know, it's like with the blessing of being in media, it's like I do have a place I could go chill a little bit that's away from the crowd. But then I get to meet so many awesome people, and the way he runs his organization, I've just always been, you know, impressed. It's such a good, it's almost like a spiritual retreat, you know, I feel like I get to go to, you know. And I've got to meet, you know, Danny Wimmer and Danny Hayes, and Danny Hayes connected me with a guy that Pat Otis, who's a member of their team now, who's a retired Navy Master Chief. And I had Pat Otis on the podcast too, because I'm retired Navy as well, you know. And it was just cool that he connected us and set that up. So it's just, I love the organization. Whenever they come around in May, it's around Armed Forces Day weekend. They always honor the troops. They always provide some kind of, tickets and stuff for the military. I got to see Nita Strauss do the Star Spangled Banner and stuff at one of, it's awesome. I can't say enough good things about, I feel blessed and honored to be involved in my little capacity with that crew.
I couldn't say it better than you just said it right there. Yeah, Danny Wimmer's like, wow, you know, to witness how he does run things and the scale of, you know, the things he takes on and the things he does, it's just, it's legendary, man. And then, lucky and grateful to have been, you know, I could have sat 5 feet from him. You know, I got invited to, I think, my first Danny Wimmer, you know, show for their first thing that I got invited to go see was I think Crown the Empire was there. It was this night at the Troubadour I went down, but they were raising money. They were trying to, somebody was going to win to get on one of the festivals, but sitting with Danny Wimmer and Bobby Shvensky from Blackcraft Cult, and they were going back and forth, daring each other to donate more than the other guy was donating. And they just kept donating thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to these charities just to outdo one another. And like, they were having fun just throwing tons of money at these charities. And by the end of the night, I don't remember what this astronomical number was, but they must have saved and changed so many lives just having fun. And to witness his generosity that close was just like, again, a reminder to like really just be grateful for the moment that you're in and to get to meet and know them. And we did this bowling tournament later, and he's just such a nice and warm guy, and I met his whole family. And then it's just like, again, one thing after the other just kind of points out that if you're following your purpose and your passion, you're going to find the plan that he's got bestowed for you. I was walking into the Danny Wimmer offices one day with Matt to do the Power Hour show. And this guy from my past walks past me, and we both did a double take of each other. And it turned out to be somebody from way back that we used to get in so much trouble, to me and this guy, and I hadn't seen him in years. It turned out he got sober about a year after I did. And he's walking out of the Danny Wimmer offices, and after we take a double take of each other, he's halfway down the hallway, and we both turn around, and I said, "Joe," and he says, "Patrick," and I was like, "What the fuck are you doing here?" And thought he's one of the talent buyers there, and now he just got promoted to be head talent buyer, I think, the casino division. So it's like there's just like all of these little nooks and crannies of like all of the places that I want to be in my life are just the doors just keep opening, just because you get up in the morning and you believe that you're going to, you know, be that person that you want to be someday, and watch it all unfold. It's really super magical. And he introduced me to Del Williams, who gets me on these new festivals, because Amanda left, you know. Amanda was our champion over there and got us on Welcome to Rockville. Now it's Del Williams and Kyle over there. And it's all a big family. You know, my attorney too, Eric German, I can't give that guy enough credit. He's been my head coach since the revamp of the band, after about the middle of the second album, I revamped the band with all the guys that are in it now. You know, he's been fundamental, and he's got all the relationships, all the love and respect from every angle, you know, in the industry too. So he's another, you know, he's like Matt in my life. I can't be more grateful for anyone like I am for him. And I just, it's all about people now, you know, it's all about people, you know. I'm just grateful for Danny Wimmer, that just, you know, I don't know him like I wish, I hope, hopefully will someday, I hope to be a personal friend, but just to have the respect and offered the opportunity to come in and be a part of something so huge is just a blessing, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure, man. I mean, I, you know, there's days that I'll get caught up in like, you know, the woe is me or the stinking thinking, and it's just like, shut up, idiot, where you remember where you were at, you know, and look how far you've come. And you know, just the fact that, you know, I mean, some of the guys that texted me on Friday just saying happy soberversary and stuff, guys that I, as a fan, look up to, you know, and now they're texting me saying, you know, they're happy for me. You know, I'm so blessed, man. So it's just like, you know, I got to quit, you know, I got to keep working on that gratitude, you know, and then the more I'm grateful for, the more stuff I'm given to be grateful for, you know. And that's what I love about this. What's part of your, like daily, routine, and your spiritual, connection?
Currently I was literally, I was alone in my apartment, you know, a couple weeks ago, I think. And, you know, I still go to church every Sunday. So that really keeps me grounded. I feel like I'm really connected with the messages that come from there. But Lately, my routine has been being of service. I've been kind of putting that off a lot, but I took on a new sponsee. And, you know, to be there to try to help somebody else, you find out that you're actually getting help too, you know?
Yeah.
Walking somebody through the steps, of course, allows me to rewalk through the steps and reevaluate my whole situation. So, you know, I've been trying to encourage him, my other sponsees to write their gratitude list. And, you know, mine is, I mean, on my phone, it would take you 100 swipes to get through it. And, there's a lot of things on that list that haven't happened yet that I'm already grateful for. And there's about 50% of the things on that list were things that that hadn't happened yet. And then I made them happen. I manifested them by being grateful for them and basically saying, you know, what do I want? You know, whether it's, you know, how's the tour bus for this tour going to come together? I need that. Or, you know, I'm grateful for the comfort and the meals for my band that are on this tour. You know, I start being grateful for that, even though it hasn't happened yet. And then, you know, if you put that in your gratitude list every day, then that becomes part of your focus. And again, not worrying about yesterday or tomorrow, you're worried about today, and that becomes your focus. And then before you know it, I put a little green check mark next to all the things that I've manifested on that list. And one by one, those things happen. So I think it's about the gratitude list. It's just being super excited about, you know, even if you stub your toe, you have to remember that maybe, you know, as small of a thing, that as stupid as that may sound, it's like, that was a distraction from something else, you know, that got you thinking about the thing that you need to think about. So even if you're having a hard time and you're going through some bad shit, to remember that, that this is happening for a reason, and remember your purpose and your passion, and know that, that with every step, no matter how hard or how easy, that is exactly the step you are supposed to be taking to get to where you want to be, need to be, and are supposed to be.
Amen, man. Awesome, Patrick. Well, I want to get ready and wrap up here with you, but I want to, and I mean, that would have been the perfect closer, but I'm going to ruin it by throwing some of the questions I normally ask my guests that I have on here before we get ready and wrap up. What class do you feel should be mandatory before graduating high school today?
Music.
Music. And then,
it's the language that we all carry with us throughout our lives. It's probably the most influential, thing in our lives. Even to people that don't think they're into music, music is the thing that gets you to reflect and make up your mind about a lot of things throughout life. So, I think definitely music.
Yeah, and what's beautiful about that too is, like, I just had. So, you know, I shared with you that I was stationed over in Kuwait during my last deployment. And last month, I interviewed a member of a Kuwaiti metal band that's, like, lives in Kuwait. So our conversation, it was definitely spiritual led. I seen when, you know, I get the emails from the PR people, hey, explaining, you know, what bands are available and this and that. And I seen Kuwait and I was like, all right, hey, let me talk to these guys. And, it wasn't just, hey, well, tell me about the music and this and that, man. It became like an amazing connection and conversation between, you know, obviously English isn't his first language, you know, but what brought us together was just the music, the language of the heart, you know, and the language of music brought us together. It ended up being an amazing conversation. It almost felt like some closure for me to be able to kind of go back, not physically, but, you know, go back there. And it ended up being a beautiful conversation, and all because of music, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, who are three people who've inspired you and you could credit for making you the person you are today?
Three. I would say it have to be four. I mean, really, it have to be my brother, my mother, my father, and my sister.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then, are there any causes or organizations that you support and encourage others to check out?
There's I've fallen in love with an organization called BAR. It's Building a Refuge. It's a suicide prevention and men's mental health organization out of Indianapolis. I love working along with them. There's another one, Lead Don't Follow. They're a, you know, rock and roll outfit that all of their proceeds go to, you know, helping people that are suffering from, you know, addiction. Just specifically, I would have to say one of those two, or, you know, I can't say AA because not everybody's in AA, but, and church, you know, your local church, you know, definitely support those people that are trying to keep a positive flow and message alive in the world.
Awesome. And then, you showed me a little bit of your toy collection today before we went on the air, but what was your favorite toy as a child?
Oh, I mean, the Star Wars stuff, you know, probably the, snow speeder from Empire Strikes Back, maybe.
Yeah. That thing was badass.
It was cool.
With the catapult thing, you know,
yeah. I got another one that later on that came out with the battle damaged one, and you put these stickers on and it looked all like it had been destroyed. I always thought that was cool too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was cool.
I mean,
we talked about it briefly, but any message you have for our military members that are currently serving overseas?
A message. Thank you. Thank you. You know, gosh, especially with everything going on in the world. I mean, your courage and your bravery, is just, you know, I'm just so grateful for you. You know, a message, I would just say, listen to some more Butter, so that helped you get through that day.
Awesome. Sounds good. And then, before, we get ready to go, anybody that's new, speaking of listening to more Butterside, anybody that's watching this program or listening and is new to hearing about Butterside and wants to support you guys and check you guys out, where would you send them?
Spotify. I mean, I'm always tempted to say go to YouTube because I put so much into the music videos, but I think the magic is in the music for sure. And if you just put on a playlist of Butterside, I think, you know, three or four songs in, you're going to be a real fan, if not right off the bat. You know, if you give us a chance, I promise you, you're going to find a space in your heart for us, because it's real deal stuff.
Nice. Awesome. Well, Patrick, man, I really appreciate the time, man. It was great talking and learning more about you today. Before I let you go, can you do me one last favor? You mind cutting a promo ID for the show? Just introduce yourself, and you're listening to Today's Boondoggle.
Today's Boondoggle.
Yeah.
B-O-O-N, doggle, boondoggle.
Yeah.
Yep. This is Pat Stone, and you are watching and listening to Boondoggle with Bill Bailey.
Awesome. Patrick, man, thanks again for your time, brother. I really appreciate it, man. It was good talking with you, and look forward to meeting you later this month.
Yeah, we'll see you in Cleveland, bro.
All right, man. You take care.
All right. You too. Thanks, bro.